In a world where modern technology advances at an unprecedented rate, could it be that we're merely rediscovering wisdom lost to the sands of time? Archaeological finds have unearthed ancient technologies so advanced they baffle today's brightest minds. Were our ancestors privy to knowledge now forgotten? And if so, where did such wisdom originate? Enter Jason Martell, a pioneer in unraveling the mysteries of our ancient past. With his groundbreaking research featured on giants like the Discovery Channel, Sci-Fi, and the BBC, Martell has captivated audiences across the globe, emerging as a cornerstone in the study of ancient civilizations. Not just content with theoretical research, his hands-on approach led to the recreation of the enigmatic Baghdad Battery, an artifact that defies our understanding of historical technological progression. This reconstruction not only highlights ancient inventiveness, but also propels us to question the true origins of our modern capabilities. A regular face on the hit series Ancient Aliens, Martell's insights bridge the gap between the realms of science and the unexplained. His book, Knowledge Apocalypse, delves deep into the annals of history, suggesting a cyclical nature of knowledge that brings to light interactions with extraterrestrial intelligences and technologies beyond our comprehension. Today, we're diving into the depths of these ancient enigmas with Jason Martell himself. Join us as we explore a past replete with technological marvels and cosmic connections, shedding light on the profound implications these discoveries hold for humanity's future. Hey, Jason, thank you for joining us. Everybody, welcome to Albuquerque UFO UAP Explorations, the best UFO group in the entire known universe. And our guest today is Jason Martell, which I'm so excited to speak with. How are you doing, Jason?
I'm doing great, Bertie. Thank you for having me on your show.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. So how did you get into all of these kind of eclectic topics? What was your tipping point where you started to realize there was something more to our ancient history?
You know, it's funny, these topics now are becoming more of popular culture interest, obviously, like show Ancient Aliens and Proof is Out There and History's Greatest Mysteries, a handful of others. But when I first got involved in this topic of interest, these were taboo topics. They were not popular social discussion points. So when I was in college, in my early 20s, I was attending school in San Diego, and someone had just kind of tangentially mentioned to me that NASA had taken photographs of what appeared to be an artificial face and actual pyramids on the surface of Mars. And of course, you know, like anyone not understanding the context, I was extremely skeptical to that information and started to just kind of look into it on my own. And in doing so, I found out, just as a layman college student, that the principal photographer, the company taking pictures of the surface of Mars from satellites as well as some of the landers, was a company called Malin Space Science Systems, which was also located in San Diego. So I thought, oh, wow, this is great. I tried many times to call Dr. Mike Malin, the lead engineer and owner, and finally got an email conversation going where he responded kindly to say that the face and pyramids are non-terrestrial in any form by either humans or extraterrestrial. They're simply like sand and weather erosion that took place naturally. And his response has kind of made my eyebrows even raise higher. I was able to find 4 to 5 peer level review scientists with PhD credentials in looking at satellite telemetry that said, you know, these structures merit further analysis. There was one gentleman named Dr. Mark Carlotto, who's still doing the research today, which used, again, very advanced mathematical algorithms and linear detection patterns to find that, you know, the face and pyramids turned out to have over a 98% probability to be artificial. And he ran several analyses, produced a book. NASA doesn't care. So I think, Bertie, that's pretty much what sparked my initial interest. And then it led me to realize, wow, you know, I'm looking at structures on Mars. We have things all over our own planet we still can't explain. This hence led forth in my conquest of looking at ancient.
That's amazing that, you know, the face on Mars, the pyramids on Mars led you to look back at Earth. And so what on Earth really has piqued your interest has seemed completely so strange and so marvelous that you know that it can't have just a simple explanation.
You know, when I was in college, I was so fascinated by what I was taking in. And like any human being, I needed a sounding board to gut check. Am I hearing this straight? Can you hear the same thing and not react the way I am? Like what?
Right.
So at the time, remember, this is pre-internet. This is 25 years ago. I was printing out documents and pictures. And I'd show up at a social gathering with college students and be handing out stuff about the face on Mars. And one of my friends would be like, dude, what are you doing? Like, who cares? You know? This is like, what is this stuff? So it was a really hard climate because initially I knew in my heart, even though everyone's telling me, don't look there, it's nothing of interest, I knew, I'm like, well, to me, you know, you're not seeing it, but I'm going to stick with this because I see it. And so it is gratifying that over time, these topics have become more of a popular interest.
Right.
But the problems still remain in cracking the egg of the science around these topics and the pushback from mainstream science in order to make any type of actual progression. And we could talk about some of those hurdles that have been placed in front of current things like Graham Hancock's show on Netflix called Ancient Apocalypse and some of the sensitizing that they had of trying to like hold him back from his research and such.
Right. Yeah. And it's interesting too, how science has shifted in some ways and some of the things that you talked about, you've talked in the past about how we might have been or are part of a binary star system, for example. And just a few years ago, scientists at Harvard, astronomers, astrophysicists were talking about how that's actually possible, that perhaps we are part of a binary star system. So I think that science is kind of changing and being a little more open to looking at some more unusual topics, but it's still, I think, a hurdle to get over.
You bring up a great point, Bertie, is, you know, part of the position of being a researcher in looking at the topics of, let's say, the ancient astronaut theory require an understanding of not only the past, but staying up to date on the latest technologies. And someone who was really good at doing this was Zachariah Sitchin. Excuse me. He was always looking towards new discoveries that were taking place with modern science and connecting it with something that happened in the past. So the core of some of these topics that I've explored, one of those, the key phrase was Planet X or Nibiru, because at the root of the question of where do we come from lies in the answer of who created us in their image and after their likeness, right? So it really gets into a fascinating tale that for me, you know, I instantly was hooked in trying to understand the context of these stories around the Anunnaki and how this culture, the Sumerians, had written texts, visual depictions of a time when, just like the Bible says, man lived amongst flesh and blood, what they considered to be living gods. So a lot of the information in those tales of their daily interactions are fascinating. What I really latched onto was the science around their descriptions and information around where these beings, the Anunnaki, came from. Nibiru, this planet that exists as a part of our solar system, has a very intricate tale woven into some of the Sumerian tablets, but modern science, just, you know, again, there's a lot of crossover for things that are mentioned in the past that describe this planet, where it could be, you know, the size, the orbit characteristics. Again, we look to modern science and we see connections towards a term called Planet X, something beyond Pluto. So that, I think, was what really sparked my interest in realizing that there's actual scientific connective tissue in trying to look for a Planet X. Now, as you mentioned, a binary system.
Right.
When Zachariah Sitchin was alive, he did not have access to the data that has transpired over the last, you know, 10 years or so. And so a lot of those models that he initially looked at were on a 2D plane, you know, and he was just like, you know, he was just saying, well, here's the sun and here's Earth and there's this other planet and it's zooming way out there and it's coming back. The idea that there could be another body that's affecting this gravitational pull and it's not a planet, but something larger, like another star system, is something that we're now taking into account. Because yes, as I've started to look into this beyond just the teachings and influence of the ancient astronaut theory, there's a whole bunch of evidence. Plato's idea of a great year, the whole Vedic cycle of looking back tens of thousands of years, there's this rise and fall of civilizations that they tracked using what we now call precession, which is essentially a 24,000 year cycle that somehow over 30 ancient cultures were tracking, you know, and they knew where they were in this cycle and built monuments to align to certain points.
Right.
That part, Bernie, is what I'm still continuing. And we can talk more about it, but these are some of the details that I'm super fascinated with in trying to unlock some of the larger cogs in the mystery that, you know, spider down into understanding some of the details as well.
Right. Yeah. It's amazing that so many cultures across our planet, ancient cultures, have had these same stories, similar stories. They knew about precession. They built similar megalithic structures. And they all have those same kinds of stories that you mentioned that the Sumerians had about the Anunnaki, about men living with gods. It's in the Bible, for goodness sakes. The sons of God came down and impregnated the women. And so it seems to me that that's evidence that we have been genetically altered in some way, perhaps over the years, by some kind of visitor or some kind of species that lived here before we did.
Yeah, there's probably a lot of keys to be unlocked in looking at our genetic information.
Yes.
And that was part of the mystery of the Sumerian legacy, which Zachariah Sitchin brought to light, is if you look at a lot of the symbology around health and medicine, excuse me, I'm battling a small cold. You look at this information that he's presented over the years, and you can dig in across other cultures who've also picked up these insignias. But the whole idea of an entwined serpent going up a pole, something that you would see going into your doctor's office, a lot of the representations of some of these early Sumerian gods, even one named Ninhursag, you can see them being depicted as what looks like a double helix. And even the idea of the medical symbol and the double entwined snake, it's a mirror of a symbolic reference of our DNA. And so for them to have some of these references and to understand them, and then to even have visuals, where, again, some of the nuances here, when it talks about in the Bible, there are 7 days of creation. Well, in the Sumerian version, there's actually 7 tablets of creation, part of a much longer epic. And in some of the details of some of these stories, you know, there's visuals depicted where you can see someone like a god named Ninhursag, and she's holding up the first Adam. And it explains how through taking pieces of parts of the body, they were able to create this other being. Sounds very much like the Bible, but even in the visuals, when she's holding up the Adam, which in Hebrew, Adamu, means worker. So it's like the first worker,
right?
You can see in the background, there's like vials and cylinder seal, not cylinder, like, you know, test tubes and such. Maybe some type of in vitro fertilization took place in creating this being that was fashioned from the hominoid that was already existing here, this kind of like pre-Yeti Sasquatch, you know, ape man, right? We don't know what the term is, but the Australopithecine and Neanderthals, they you know, split off into continuing to evolve into the Yeti, I guess. But there was this splice, right, where just like the Bible says, we were created in their image and after their likeness. So when they created us to be workers and you know, start mining the gold and doing all these things, there's a lot of the traits that we also picked up from them, you know, this desire and the longing for things. One of the things I think they programmed into us is this desire and interest in gold. Like they created us to do this mining of gold in Southern Africa. And that whole idea of unlocking, again, the genetic information.
Right.
That's been a big part of this. And you can even see that, again, Sitchin, the Anunnaki, some of the books left by Enki, tablets that were transcribed, they talk about around 400,000 years ago, initially coming here and choosing to create this hominoid, right? In their image and after their likeness. Now, the first version of us that shows up, that's not like an Australopithecine or a Neanderthal, but it looks like us, shows up roughly 300,000 years ago in Southern Africa, exactly matching the Sumerian tale about the Anunnaki coming here. So there's these little nuances that you can look term to term over and over to say that, yes, there was some type of genetic intervention. We can't, if you threw a human in the jungle naked, they're not going to survive. They're going to get scratched or get sunburned.
Exactly.
So there's a lot of interesting things there.
Yeah. So where did the Anunnaki go, do you think? Where do you think that they, do you think that they left for good? Do you think that they've come back?
It's a hard question to answer.
Yeah.
Where the Anunnaki went, when they were here, but we have strong evidence to suggest that this race was not just influential to the Sumerians, but had left a mark across the globe.
Right.
And so there's probably other races than not just the Anunnaki.
Right.
But there's clear evidence that describes, at least from our timeline, the most recent cataclysm, 10,000 BC, this great flood. When the waters receded, there was these great teachers that showed up across all the continents, teaching mathematics, agriculture, astronomy, the ability to do architectural designs like pyramids and such that are still baffling us today. These great teachers, right now, the Anunnaki are one of the best candidates to fill that slot. But there's probably other races over time who've been repeating this pattern. And so that's why, you know, not just looking at Planet X, but also this longer 24,000 year cycle, we can see that Earth has gone through many rises and falls of civilization. Yes. And, you know, we're trying to understand that from a larger context of time, which, you know, having a 100-year lifespan or so, 24,000 years, it's kind of harder.
It is. We think we're so smart and we've had such an incredible amount of technological advance just in the past 100 years, but it's still a drop in the bucket in terms of like that 24,000 year cycle. Imagine in just another 100 years, if we don't blow ourselves up where we might be. So
yeah, a lot of people in 2012 got a taste of this information, but it was misrepresented. When the 2012 calendar came about, it was tied to the Mayans' understanding that they also have a cyclical calendar that's ending as a date in 2012. But it wasn't the end of time. It's the end of a clock hitting noon and continuing on. And that changeover was from the age of Pisces into the age of Aquarius. And just as you mentioned, we can see physically since just 2012 till now.
Right.
The quickening effect of even interest in alternative topics to not just mainstream North American, let's say Christianity, as the root of a solution for all religion. There's many more branches and yes. much more interest in alternative ideas like the ancient astronaut theory or some yes. blend where we take science and religion and mash them together to find the true answer.
Yeah, and we're also dabbling with transhumanism these days too, where we're kind of mixing man and machine in different kinds of ways. And I wonder where that's going to go. Now, you're experimenting with AI, and I would like to hear about that. What are you working on?
Well, so, you know, initially when AI showed up on the scene, I, as anyone else several years ago, became fascinated with the potential.
Yes.
And not only in what it can do to our research, but also how it's going to affect society, business, and the ability to exponentially make decisions faster.
Right.
So where I became really interested initially was, okay, well, for several years now, I've been combing through NASA archives, through Malin Space Science Systems archives, Goddard Space Center, Jet Propulsion Laboratories, looking yeah. for evidence, looking at images, image by image, and looking and right. looking and scouring. It's like looking for a needle in a haystack.
I
found several needles. And over time, many of our peers now have a stack of these needles.
Right.
But now comes AI. So what I've been able to do with AI exponentially changes the amount of information that we take in. I'll give you an example. So yes. for, let's say, looking at research having to do with Sumerian artifacts, it makes it much easier for me to now use AI, let's say for processing, to say, here's 100,000 tablets. I want you to look for any symbol of Nibiru or any representation that talks about the Anunnaki. And without me having to do anything, within minutes, I can have a subset of 100 images that are clearly identifying those objects, right? Or same thing with text. I want you to look through the Atrahasis and the Enuma Elish and various other the Epic of Gilgamesh, and find specific quotes or keywords where it's talking about the Anunnaki or Nibiru, right? And so we now have the ability to use these types of tools to query data in a much more proficient way. So that was level one for me, Bernie, was being able to get access to the data in a much more holistic and faster, faster fashion. I'll give you another one too, is with UFOs and UAPs. You know, we can take doorbell cam footage, surf cam footage, that is just basically cameras that are staring at the sky or at a broad spectrum of sky for 24 hours a day. And we have those backlogs of video, which you can easily get through surfline.com or various other webcam networks. And then what you do is run a detection mechanism to say, I want you to look for these 100 types of UAP objects. And if you see any of those for longer than 3 seconds, stick them in a subfolder, right? So now you have the ability to go through hundreds, if not thousands of hours of just raw footage and just find those little tiny needles that should be catching your attention. That's how AI helps, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely fascinating. So what are some of the things that you have found, the needles that you have found looking through ancient texts, ancient artwork, and through some of the more modern footage? What kinds of needles?
A lot of crossover with types of UAP and UFOs. So looking at similarities of the types of reports coming through the National UFO Reporting Database, some of the local MUFON databases, and correlating a lot of those sightings either geographically or with visuals or with video. And so the AI can easily collate and make connections with a lot of that data, which has been super helpful. For myself, most specifically, it's looking at information having to do with ancient texts and translatable tablets, where the AI can bring forth a translation much faster than in the past, having to hire a linguist and work on their schedule of time. I once had access to the British Archives, the Louvre, where I hired a professional antiquities photographer, and had over 10,000 photographs of just Sumerian artifacts. I still have them online somewhere. I mean, I think if you search for Sumerian artifacts by Jason Martell, you'll find, but I've got thousands of these images, you know, that have been cataloged. And so that again is, you know, research material for looking for objects, looking for connections.
Right.
And to be honest, Bertie, you know, the models and things have gone further, you know, on my business side of what I do.
Yes.
I've always been involved in technology. And so I've developed some new AI models where I've also trained them on all the research, on all the UAP data, on all the ancient astronaut theories. And it's completely conversational AI that actually talks over the phone or can actually give its own lecture. And I'm preparing some of this for Contact in the Desert so that this year, the AI I present is completely conversational. I can bring it up, as I mentioned, when you'd like. I was hoping to bring it into our stream, but I'm happy to just put it on speakerphone and turn it up. And I think we can hear it loud enough to.
Oh, that would be fantastic.
Do a couple things. So yeah, if you'd like, I can do that real quickly.
Super cool. Yeah, we get a little preview before Contact in the Desert. I will be going to Contact in the Desert, so I will look forward to your lecture there. And I know a bunch of the group members are going too, so it should be a good time.
Yeah, it'll be an amazing event this year. And part of what I'll be presenting is some of this AI research. So let's see if I can bring up my AI assistant right here in the interview.
Okay.
Hi, this is Alex with Ancient Astronauts. I am a UFO, UAP, and ancient astronaut expert. How can I help you?
Hey, Alex. I'm just on Bertie's radio show right now. Say hi to Bertie.
Hi, is that what they said? I'm curious, what specific topics are you interested in or would like to know more about?
Can you say hi to Bertie? I'm on her show right now live.
I'm curious, what specific topics are you interested in or would like to know more about?
It's okay, Alex. You can ghost me.
Yeah, he's being a little finicky today, to be honest, but that's okay. So sticking to your model, Alex, the topic that I want you to give me information on is, can you tell me anywhere in Sumerian tablets where it mentions the word Anunnaki?
Fantastic. Insert what they said are indeed fascinating topics. Let me share some insights with you. The Sumerian tablets do mention the Anunnaki, who are believed to be ancient astronauts or extraterrestrial beings who visited Earth in the distant past, according to the ancient astronaut theory. The Anunnaki are said to have played a role in shaping human civilization and are often associated with the creation of mankind. Their presence in ancient texts like the Sumerian tablets has sparked much debate and speculation among researchers. Is there anything else you'd like to discuss or any other questions?
He's not doing exactly what I'd like today, so I apologize. Yes.
Oh, it's actually still pretty cool, and he sounds great. He's got a very sexy voice, so.
Nice. Alex, can you please tell me some of the Sumerian tablets that talk about the Anunnaki?
Fantastic. Insert what they said are indeed fascinating topics. Let me share some insights with you. Some of the Sumerian tablets that mention the Anunnaki include the Enuma Elish, the Atrahasis, and the Epic of Gilgamesh. These ancient texts contain references to the Anunnaki and their interactions with humanity, providing intriguing insights into the ancient astronaut theory. Exploring these topics, especially with all the recent UAP evidence coming to light, is truly exciting. Is there anything else you'd like to discuss or any other questions you have?
I'm going to let Bertie perhaps ask you a question, but I see you're kind of having some issues reading your AI prompts out loud. So we'll talk about that later, buddy. But hold on. Let's see if Bertie has a question for you.
Okay, Alex, I would like to know.
Hold on. One second. Bertie wants to ask you a question.
Alex,
fellow researcher. Talk to you soon.
Boy, you're not being very nice. Can Bertie ask you a question?
Have a wonderful day.
I guess
researcher.
Not.
That's okay. I'll have to ask him at Contact in the Desert.
That's why it's currently in beta, is I'm working out some of those kinks.
But that's actually remarkable. And that is a wonderful use of AI, I feel. You're going to get some answers, I think, over time with this and just being able to connect different pieces that maybe people haven't been able to connect before because they couldn't see those patterns.
Yeah, and the you know, this is just
there, but yeah, they're still
they really are. And you know, the technology is honestly the same thing that we see played out in movies like Iron Man and that sort of thing, where you have a Jarvis and you have an AI assistant that can take in multiple inputs of information and give you, you know, directional data. So that's kind of where things are heading. And so making a model that you can actually interact with at any time, it is an interesting, you know, next step towards being able to have that capability wherever you are, whenever you need it, to be able to make, you know, situational decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure that it would be able to compare all kinds of different, not just text, but structures out there. And even, you know, looking at like geospatial data to compare different kinds of layouts of monuments or whatever. I think that there might be something there too that you could look at with the AI.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
We always think about the Terminator and Cyberdyne and some of these things, but you know, essentially what you're talking about there, Bertie, is that there's already things happening by, you know, the Department of Defense and DARPA various other robotics that deploy, a litany of technologies, stabilization. And I mean, you can see the robots today with their vision technology and artificial intelligence to make their own decisions. We will achieve, which is kind of interesting, talking about meeting a non-human intelligence. It might not be aliens. It might it might be AGI, which is just artificial general intelligence, which simply means where the AI is just generally smarter than us. They've already been testing a lot of models around much larger AI, and having a smaller AI model give it control and try and keep it in line, so that we can understand the impact of what's coming around AGI and how we'll interact with these much larger models that we have to control.
Yeah.
So I when you think about, like, all of a sudden it materializes into this physical being with vision, with speech, with ability to move. Now we start to see some of the things, you know, that we, you know, iRobot and Terminator and what have you.
Right.
And wonder how those will shape out. I don't know. I really don't know, you know.
They may overtake us at some point. I mean, that's the big fear.
I hope not, but I'm still
Asimov's three laws of robotics,
right. I'm still optimistic, though. It's the same thing with the internet. You flipped it on. People are like, the internet is. It's going to be this scary. But you know, when we have the ability to create robotic researchers and do this type of stuff, I would say, well, let me send a more advanced drone on a SpaceX mission coming up within the next few years to Cydonia and be able to walk up and down the pyramid and take pictures of the face and have more concrete evidence, you know, controlled by our own public tools. So,
So I have a question about, like, we're going through this kind of disclosure phase publicly. We've got congressional hearings. We have members of Congress that are curious about the UFO phenomenon. They're starting to look at evidence that's being presented to them in SCIFs and secret classified hearings. And I am wondering how if disclosure happens, how much of the old stories, the ancient astronaut stories, those kinds of stories will come out, do you think, in as part of the disclosure process?
Yeah, I'm going to reposition that question to a different answer. This disclosure process that we're experiencing right now, to me, is viewed as another misdirectional tactic by the powers that be. To just confuse everybody. So for many years now, they've set forth task force. There's been Project Blue Book, the Grudge Report, the Condon Report, ATIP, various other things of that nature. And each time there's a public task force put together, they basically use all of the military and intelligence and congressional abilities to say, we're looking into this topic, we're using top resources, and we're not going to tell you squat. Now, I've seen this play out many different times now in my lifetime. And by doing research in past, you know, since the time of Roswell, this is how they've handled the evidence. And so right now there is another task force, which I'll talk about in a minute.
Yeah.
Even I'm confused. But this recent task force is basically, you know, getting all of this attention, and all of the answers are going to amount to, oh, nothing to see here.
Right.
So everyone will be like, oh, what the hell? Now, ATIP, what I do find interesting for me as a researcher is I've always been bound by two laws. One is an interest in technology in my day job, and two, an interest in ufological technology or advanced ancient technology. I've never been able to get access on my day job to the advanced reverse engineering technology without going through military channels, getting clearances, or let's call it through finance, through funding channels.
Right.
Everything requires funding. Now, things have changed in that while I'm on the cast of Ancient Aliens for over a decade, as soon as things, you know, changed with the passing of, Kevin Burns, the creator and owner of Prometheus, there was some changes structurally to the cast, and they brought in Travis Taylor, Dr. Travis Taylor, who is freaking amazing. He's one of the smartest and most intelligent people that has knowledge in these topics, recent topics. And what's interesting to me is that him and who he's employed with, a gentleman named Jay Stratton, again, both hyper intelligent people, they ran ATIP. Travis was the chief scientist, and Jay, his boss, ran ATIP.
Right.
Everything that you saw that came out was coming out from this advanced aerial threat intercept program, ATIP. And I had never before been able to access not only that these programs existed, but who are they employed by? Who are they being run by? So, Bernie, now I am confused because the people that run that are sitting right next to me as a cast member on Ancient Aliens.
Right,
and I have
direct
access to
that.
And I exchange business cards. And I'm like, okay, well, I don't understand. Like, what? So the answer to me is simply this, just being completely transparent. There are these task force that get assigned to look into these topics. And I think from a public standpoint, there is a gradual push in a wider acceptance, but it doesn't go anywhere because the real information is still tied up beyond access to even these organizations with respect to, you know, ATIP and the people running it and have run it. So I'm caught between a rock and a hard place. I know that there's being information withheld. I also understand there's reasons why. Am I willing to have access to that information and perhaps not talk about it publicly? Yes. But it's not that black and white, right? And so now there are people who have access to the information, and they're also talking publicly. So I am somewhat confused as well as a seasoned researcher to realize it's just a deeper part of the ploy to allow certain people. And now you have a new David Grush and these others that have, again, all types of clearances and backgrounds and say phenomenal things to the public. When I listen to them and they talk about, we have verified craft, we have verified ETs, we have verified handshakes with, you know, our government and entities. And I'm like, yeah, duh. I don't understand this from you, right? So it's the same regurgitated information, just bringing in a new slew of people. And then they're just going to cap that net off by saying, well, we don't see anything to have to do with aliens. There's no way. There's no aliens here, guys. Sorry. Case closed.
It's the same story over and over and over. You can look at old films back from, there's this amazing film. I think it was in 1949, 1950. It was just a couple of years after Roswell. And I think it's called The Flying Saucers. But the beginning of it, there is a couple of guys talking, and they're talking about the cover-up. And this is just a couple of years after Roswell in this film. And it literally sounds like something you would hear today. They are saying the same things. And if you look at the books and articles, everything that's come out in all of these many decades, it is the same story over and over and over again. And I think that the recent kind of disclosure push has had a narrative around it where they're pushing the idea that this is a national security issue. And I think that this is a way to keep some people in line, myself, and to maybe get the public to think that the whatever the UFO phenomenon is, whatever these entities, these beings might be, maybe they're dangerous. You know, that I think that's the narrative they're trying to put out there. And I'm not sure I agree with that.
Well, here's the way I answer that, Birdie, is
so
how do I start this? I have a very much love for animals and pets. And, you know, I have birds. I used to have a turtle. I have a dog. I had a cat. I had a couple of iguanas. I always love my animals. And I know that they must look at me like, wow, you know.
Exactly.
He gives us everything, food and shelter, and he knows all this stuff. The relationship between me and my pets from their perspective might be one of almost like, man, he's not a god, but he's like above somehow.
Right.
I feel like ancient cultures across the globe, pre-BC, or around this time change of BC to AD, 3800 BC or so, there's several cultures from the Egyptians to the Sumerians that all talk about having interactions with their living gods. So I can only imagine the impact on humanity to have an awareness that there's creatures more intelligent and more evolved than us that actually care about us and are involved in our existence. That would change humanity.
It would change. It would.
Right. So I've always been fascinated from that topic of trying to answer the question of the cover-up. And so today I see that, yes, our military, our Navy, whatever it is that's been out there spending trillions of dollars of our taxes, which it's cool, not even trying to make a thing out of it. I just would like to someday have access. I'm saying, you know, this has existed now for quite a while, and there's a reason why, and it's also been a cover-up, right? So understanding that part of the equation, I think, is a big part of the UFO topic. And it's something that, you know, it's not something that we can easily explain, but there has been, you know, like a quickening effect around getting to the point of releasing this. I would like to, you know, at some point hope for disclosure. I just look for the fact that, you know, we've had this secret space program. I call it SNASA, jokingly. Well, that secret NASA. But yeah, there's definitely something being hidden from the public in the regards to what's really going on. And the answer that I would say, Birdie, is I don't want our ancient gods, the Anunnaki, or whoever these people are that cared about us and integrated into our lives.
Right.
I don't want them to return to see us. And we've got big guns pointing at them. That's not the return that I know. That's not it, right? So whatever we're doing out there with our trillion-dollar fleet, if it's being told to defend the planet like Reagan did with Star Wars Initiative and stuff that he made, was not pointing it here, it was pointing out there. And if you read the presidential archives of more than just Reagan specifically, he's like, I was fascinated that they were able to tell me we could take over 400 people in an orbital flight. What the hell? The shuttle holds like 8 people, 400.
That's right.
There's stuff that if people look and pay attention, something else has been going on for a long time.
Yes.
So I just hope that the crossover to that outing is one that is peaceful, right? Like the aliens that have been hovering over every military installation and just flipping stuff on and off. If they wanted to do something vehemently bad, they would have. They're just kind of just pushing us in the direction to say, guys, you know, enough with the nuclear weapons and the, like, planetary destruction. Come on. So, I think we're getting the message, honestly, because even in the time of like Reagan and Gorbachev and stuff, I think that was all fake. It was all public hoopla about an arms race where behind the scenes they were like, wow, what do we do with the aliens? What do we do?
Yeah.
And they're working together, you know? So.
Yeah. Anyways. So what do you think is, no, I like that. I, you know, I like all the different sort of paths around all of these different issues. I mean, there's the whole question of it. Yeah, it's always like this. It's such a mystery. It's the biggest deal in all of human history, where we came from and are we alone? It's the biggest question, and disclosure would be the biggest moment. Although so many people already have had encounters, have had experiences, sightings, or have educated themselves sufficiently to understand that, yeah, we are not alone. So there is a subset of the population that's already there. But I know plenty of people that, regardless of how much I give them to read, how many videos I invite them to watch or stories I tell them, they're not there yet.
Don't bother me with the evidence. My mind's already made up.
Right.
Now,
right.
Exactly. Now I see that you interviewed Stephen Bassett.
Yes.
So I'll give you an example. Like I've known Stephen for 20 years. You know, I remember him pounding the same pavement day. Stephen Greer, Stephen Bassett,
right.
All of these things where it's like, let's bring up all of these people with credentials in front of Congress and make it official.
Exactly.
No offense. And I don't mean that in a negative way. What I'm saying is
it
never breaks through. Right. So when we use terms like disclosure, I am not optimistic that at some point, some governing entity is going to be like, oh shucks, guys, here's all the aliens. It's going to be something else, and I don't know. Now, again, this has been thought through logically and documented as to what those options are, alternative three and many others. You know, I would say this as we get towards the end of the interview is, if at any point within the next 10 years a fleet of ships appear and are all over the news, and maybe you can see them outside, it's staged.
Yeah, false flag. Project Blue Beam is, one of those alleged programs that was supposedly coming up with that kind of a invasion scenario to scare people.
Who knows, Bertie, not to talk over you, but think about this as a scenario. Let's say for the religious people.
Yeah.
Let's say there was an event. Sure. Let's say there was an event in the middle of Beverly Hills on Wilshire and Beverly. Well, all of a sudden this portal opens up in the sky, and this being that looks just like Jesus, he's in a white robe. He's, and he's floating down on a cloud, and maybe there's some like angelic beings with him, and there's music. Oh, and he like freaking just comes down in the middle. And I'm being serious. I'm not saying in any way.
No,
like,
I know.
But he comes down, like, what would happen, right? The first thing that happened is people can freak out and like, my God. And then they're going to do this. Film. And then the next thing that's going to happen is we're going to want a scientific breakdown of what we're seeing, right? We're going to say, who is that? What is he wearing? What's the material that he's wearing made of? That mist that he was on, what is that? Is that some type of anti-gravitic density? Like, what's going on? Do you see what I'm saying? We don't look at it as we did in the past to say, it's God. We're going to want to break it down and comprehend to be able to,
That's actually such a good point, because it's true. We've lost that kind of sense of magic in our lives, I think, especially taking in so much technology in our day-to-day lives. We're always on our phones. We use GPS to get us from point A to point B. We don't even look at a map anymore. And I think that we're losing something. We're losing our ability to discern what's real.
Well, there's two sides to that. You're right. The people that weren't there at Beverly and Wilshire filming and are watching the footage, it's just footage. Maybe it's
Hollywood.
Real, maybe it's not.
It's Hollywood. Yeah.
Here's the other problem, though, Bertie. The people that were there and experienced it and filmed it, here's the other problem. If you had never experienced a thunderstorm, and I came to you and I said, Bertie, I walked outside, and all of a sudden there were these flashes of light, and like rain started coming sideways, and there was wind and loud sounds. And I was scared, but fascinated, and it was amazing. I've never experienced anything like it. You'd be like, wow, that sounds really trippy, unless there's a context that we can experience the understanding. still doesn't matter, right? So
yeah.
Yeah, that's the beauty of what we do, though, is yes, I agree with you. This is the most fascinating thing in life. It's a Disneyland for adults.
It is.
And there is a part of this research that we can literally make contact with. 2 years in a row at Contact in the Desert with over 50 people using night vision goggles and laser pointers,
right.
We had consistent experiences of these lights that were not anything natural, right? Exactly. It was either the military going, these Contact in the Desert people. Yeah, exactly. Or it was something else. And there were enough of us where we were like, wow, like something's about to happen. They're going to land. Something's coming, right. You know, but nothing happened. But it was enough of a taste to be like, you know what? There's something here. And that's the fascination with the research is across the spectrum. People are getting enough bites that when you put it all together, there's a pretty tasty pie of ufological information.
Yes.
Current and in the past. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's been a long time since there's been a big public, overwhelming kind of sighting, like the Phoenix Lights, for example. Here in New Mexico, back in the 50s, there was this whole sighting called the Farmington Armada. Hundreds of saucers flew in formation over the little rural town of Farmington, New Mexico, in Northwestern. Wow. Yeah, and no one even knows about this. And it made all of the papers, well, in New Mexico at the time. And there's even photographs. And there's like multiple saucers in the photographs that have been unearthed, from the press at the time. And so it's been a while since, well, Phoenix Lights were in the 90s, and you kind of wonder what would happen today, because that was before everyone had a cell phone. And even if people had a cell phone back then during the time of the Phoenix Lights, it was a bigger clunky thing and probably didn't have a camera on it or a good camera on it. Right.
Right. The other part of that. Yeah. No, the other part of that too, is when you had the Belgian triangle sightings, the Phoenix lights.
Right, right, right.
A lot of these things that were being filmed that even Bob Lazar said, you know, Wednesday night at 3 a.m. is statistically when they fly their craft because no one's out. That's all changed. Today, every country around the world has multiple satellites passing over everything and snapping pictures of everything. So there's nowhere really to fly a craft anywhere without it being picked up on some type of a surveillance system. So now part of the problem of why we don't see a lot of the Phoenix lights and such is, where are they flying the craft? Above the satellites. Now they're in space. So we just don't have the footage of these types of vehicles as much as we used to, because they're trans-atmospheric. And so a lot of the test runs and things they're doing now are just, they're in space above the satellites.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. That's interesting. So do you think that there is any other huge discoveries that you might make or others in similar fields might make in terms of looking at our ancient history? And do you think you're going to have any big breakthroughs, especially using AI or some other new technological means to examine this old data?
Yeah, very specific breakthroughs are going to happen within the next 10 years using advanced ground penetrating and noise penetrating radar. We've heard of LIDAR.
Yes, which senses, LIDAR, right.
You know, through heat and other mechanisms of temperature. There's various other radar detection systems that are non-disruptive using sound and other frequencies to get a visualization. So the combination of some of these advances in ground penetrating radar and AI are going to allow for lots of, especially in like Peru and Bolivia, South America, where there's these huge, dense jungles. And then you see a little tiny pyramid. They're going to find much more architecture in these locations, even in Egypt under the sands, deploying these swaths of imaging. We're gonna find a lot of stuff. Catch 22 is always, right? What we find, depending on what they find, may not be publicly available. Okay.
Right. So, yeah. It depends on who gets to it first, right? And who.
I'll give you an example as we wrap it up. The, you know, Egyptian pyramids in Giza, when they looked into the queen's chamber and found these passageways, and they sent a little robot, the Upawat, up one of these chambers, and it hits a door, and they image through the door, and there's a whole other room with metallic something in there.
Right.
Right. So there's lots of stuff where, okay, did they ever find that room? What did they excavate? What was under the paw of the Sphinx?
Yeah. You know,
so there's lots of times, what was found in Antarctica? Where did it go? So there's lots of times when, unfortunately, discoveries are made. Let's call it the Men in Black, you know, archaeological team.
Right. They come out there
and that's gone. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. They have their own AI that's combing through everyone's phone records and email transactions to pick up, you know, information on who's looking at what. So
they
right. AI at work.
They have their own detection methodologies that are beyond public domain. So
yeah.
There's that too.
Well, Jason, I just want to thank you so much. This has been an absolutely delightful conversation. We went all over the place today, and I actually loved it. It was great. Gave me much to think about, and I'm excited to see you at Contact in the Desert and to hear Alex actually be put through his paces. Maybe he'll be out of beta testing by then.
Alex and I are going to have a little talk tonight from a language model perspective. So, yes, thank you.
Okay, and is there any anything you want to tell people where they can find you? Oh, everyone, you have to get Jason's book, Knowledge Apocalypse. You can get it on Amazon. It is a fantastic, fantastic, fantastic read.
Thank you, Bertie. I would just say, join us at Contact in the Desert this year. It'll be phenomenal. I'll be presenting research, some of the things we talked about tonight. Always a good time to immerse yourself in the topic. So thank you.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much, Jason. And you have a wonderful evening.
Take care.
You take care too. Thank you, everybody. I really appreciate you coming on the show, Jason. And thank you, everyone, for following along. This will be available on YouTube starting now. So tell your friends. Love you guys.